when I advise companies, I have my own little measure, which is you're selling X, Y, and Z. I'm like, do only young white guys buy X, Y, and Z? Some people don't take it well. I had an old white guy tell me I was triggering him when I asked the question about what he was doing, which I was like, really? If you can't be challenged by the team you're building and the audiences you're trying to reach, then I'm not sure you should be in this business.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. One of the ways that people are pushing the progressive ecosystem forward is by offering both help with funding and expertise in entrepreneurship. My guest today is Kathleen Warner, who has brought her connections and a broad expertise in entrepreneurship to the political space, with a particular interest in election administration and voting rights. Kathleen was trained as an attorney, worked as COO and member of the founding team of the Startup America Partnership. She has also acted as entrepreneur in residence and strategic advisor for corporations, nonprofits, advocacy groups, entrepreneurial organizations, early stage companies, and venture firms. We had an interesting conversation about how Kathleen has sought to navigate the progressive political space, looking for ways to be helpful, as well as what she's learned from her past at Startup America and other organizations. So, after a quick word with our sponsor, my interview with Kathleen Warner with Inspire Ventures.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yeah, sure. I am Kathleen Warner. I'm a builder and doer and pollinator. I like doing big and possible things, which I started out as a mission-driven attorney and worked in financial services and have done a bunch of things over time, including being the founding COO of the Startup America Partnership, which is a national network of entrepreneurial communities. And as I said, I like to build and create big and possible things. And right now, I'm deep into election administration and voting rights, which is important and significant at any time in our democracy, but feels certainly particularly of the moment and acute right now when we're really working to ensure safe and secure elections for all American voters.
And it does fit into the category of big and unfortunately a little bit impossible things, doesn't it?
It feels like that. And I'm a little bit of, I'm a lot of a contrarian and certainly a fighter. And, you know, my hackles can go up when someone says, you know, something can't be done or it's too hard or it's too difficult or this is the way it is. So I both appreciate that challenge and am frankly deeply neurotic and concerned. But at the end of the day, you know, I need to do something. So that's what I'm doing. It does. I in some ways can't think about it too much because I can get pulled down into that, oh my gosh, how is this all going to get done? But it will. There are many, many really wonderful, smart people who are very much focused on, you know, our democracy and ensuring this election in particular. And we, you know, see in a very clear-eyed way what some of the challenges are from, you know, not only the health challenges with COVID, the recognition around racial injustice and what it has meant for voter suppression and voting rights, and really what the opportunity is in our world, you know, around this particular election and beyond.
If I understand things correctly, your work in election administration, voting rights, must be through Inspire Ventures, which is your investment group?
That's just my vehicle. It's more of a, you know, an advisory consultative entity than a venture arm. I like to do things, I like to roll up my sleeves and with you know, good projects and with good people and find things that are already, sometimes already in motion, or with a little push, sweat equity money can be put in motion. And so, and I was doing that just, and I was like, well, gosh, I should actually set up an entity through which to do it. So it's me doing things with like-minded folks in my fairly prodigious network of people. So I'm with the election administration, I'm partnering with a longtime dear friend, serial entrepreneur, Jesse Fink, who is one of the founders of Priceline, and longtime more like climate activist and environmental impact investor, and as well as philanthropist, and someone who's cared very deeply about democracy, largely up until now, by, again, with impact in environment and some media, but also by supporting progressive candidates and progressive entities like DCCC, DSCC, DNC, et cetera, et cetera. And then in this instance, really, we just started talking and saw this, frankly, you know, crisis on hand kind of looming before even the Wisconsin primary back in, gosh, whenever that was, and feels like a lifetime ago. And we just started talking and so said, where, you know, what is the portfolio of opportunities that we can build out, provide some seed capital, and look at these initiatives as one would a investment portfolio, and not necessarily a company, if you will, but an opportunity. And so some of it is, you know, there's some, we're doing some work that he was one of the original investors in the Stacey Abrams film that just, that has partnered with Amazon around, you know, the history of voter suppression, as well as, you know, what is needed in terms of voter registration. And Stacey Abrams is an executive producer on that, along with a number of other prominent C3 organizations. And there's a large push around the film to get more folks to register to vote, to engage in the civic process going forward. So that's one piece of the portfolio. There's a Jesse has a deep interest in journalism. So we've are also doing some work with a group called Ground Truth, the Ground Truth Project, and Charlie Sennett, funding emerging journalists to tell the untold stories around elections and voting rights. And that is at the cusp of an announcement about who those emerging journalists would be in places across the country, particularly in some of the swing states, but in other places that have stories that just are not getting out within the press, in part, which is sort of the mega story around the you know, both the attacks on the press and the collapse of traditional media and funding, which, you know, something media and reporting and journalism so essential at any time, but certainly right now. And you see just well-respected platforms and outlets experiencing just incredible stressors and sometimes, you know, just really existential threats. So that's another piece of it. We're also working on amplifying nonpartisan, cross-partisan voices in support of safe and secure elections in a number of different ways that are not yet public, but to combat a lot of the disinformation about what, you know, whether it's vote by mail, whether it's about, you know, the dangers, but also the protections that need to be put in place around safe and secure polling places and the need for additional poll workers and plans, and then activating again, non-traditional voices, but trusted voices to support our election process, because it, you know, it affects all Americans. It's not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue, or shouldn't be.
How did you get to know Jesse, and how did you come together to do something to create this portfolio?
So Jesse and I, we've known each other for, gosh, probably 26, 27 years. Jesse and his wife, Betsy, lived in Wilton, Connecticut, where I raised my kids and spent a good chunk of my life, the adult life, if you will. And they were neighbors. Betsy was out running one day and stopped in to say hello. And we've been, you know, incredibly close friends ever since. Our eldest kids were in each other's weddings. You know, we just, you know, share a view of the world, enough of a view of the world we bring things to the table that we support, challenge one another, and just have a deep and abiding friendship about, you know, that's lasted, as I said, 26, 27 years. we've never worked together before, but we both care about elections. I've spent more time in that space, having worked for a congressman for a period of time back in 2008, 2013, have done some political fundraising, have done voter protection as an attorney, and tend to get involved along the way, usually as an incredibly enthusiastic volunteer. Jesse and Betsy have just been concerned about what is going on within our democracy, and particularly within election administration. Just reached out and said, what are you thinking about secretaries of state as the potential main driver around fixing a broken system? And because, I'd done this work in Connecticut when I was working on campaigns here, and Connecticut's a funny little place in a lot of ways, with 172 little towns and therefore separate sets of rules around voting and voting admin and separate funding mechanisms and all that. So we started in one place, working through a secretary of state and funding, which was not really the path to go, but we took a very entrepreneurial approach. I stood back and said, what's the problem? And then what are the solutions? And we did our own customer discovery around what would the solution needed to be, talking to the folks on the ground who've been doing this work for a really long period of time. So talking with the National Vote at Home folks, talking with Brennan, talking with folks at Schmidt Futures, who's working in this space, the Center for Secure and Modern Elections. It's, for our future, when we all vote, one of my strengths is the breadth of my relationships over time. And that, people travel, while they may not stay in the same place, they travel in different circles. So a friend that I worked on an election with turned out to be the founder of the Voting Rights Lab and is now working with a bunch of progressive organizations around this very issue. And so it was more just to start out with a concept, seeing that there was a problem, really further defining that problem, and then testing a bunch of solutions, and really not wanting to go into a space where there was already a fairly, significant approach to it, be it, a legal approach to like a Perkins Coie or something like that, or, a mature voter registration operation already in place, but finding those opportunities where some seed capital or some sweat equity or some collaboration opportunities were explored, a little bit more deeply is where we've been putting some time. And so, it came out of a long-term friendship that was built on mutual respect, trust, having some fun together, and, sort of deep curiosity. And we've just been going hard at it. And I had just left my job in Texas, which was an interesting little side journey for me. We just decided we needed to sort of get in this and roll up our sleeves and start to put some pieces together in ways that other folks may not be putting them together. So we're, there's the two of us in terms of, so we're not truly an operation, right? It's more just like where can we bring others along and where can we access others to bring them together? So I was on a call today that was just that, taking a group of design thinkers and epidemiologists that are thinking about, voting sites with a group that's accessing big voting, potential spaces to be polling places. So that's how it came out. We liked each other. We knew each other. We trusted one another, and we figured together we could figure out some stuff.
You said he was a founder of Priceline. What was his?
Yeah. Jesse was one of the founders. I feel like he was chief operating officer. One of my favorite moments there was when Steve Blank wrote this long article the day after we launched and said, Start America is dead in the water. Nothing will ever happen outside of Silicon Valley. This notion of partnering with all these people is a bunch of nonsense. And then a year later, he stood up on stage at South by Southwest and said he was wrong. And we had done pretty amazing things. It would tell the story about how Priceline started in that hotbed of entrepreneurial activity, Norwalk, Connecticut. And it's in our DNA. Entrepreneurial, creativity, innovation is really in America's DNA. And I think sometimes for a whole bunch of reasons, we lose sight of that. People are either told that there's a certain kind of person that's an entrepreneur. There's only a certain kind of person that's a creator or a builder. It's just not true. We're a creative, curious group of folk who built a whole country on it. Talk about a crazy, impossible idea, right? Democracy, crazy, impossible idea. It's under threat and it's still an aspiration for too many people here. With Priceline, Jesse was, again, my neighbor. So I kind of saw, sat at his kitchen table when they were talking about the name. And I'm like, Priceline, do we put it together? Do we capitalize the L? Do we, do we hire Bill Shatner? It's just like, so super fun times, back in the day where, I think we tend to forget even the, you know, the internet and the power of the internet and the power of online platforms. And, you know, I later got to work with Startup America with Steve Case, who was part of that original, you know, group of individuals when they all fit in one room about, you know, with AOL, who were really visionary thinkers about that path. And Jesse came on with Jay Walker, who is the person who's been the face of Priceline for a long time and himself a serial, you know, he's a serial entrepreneur. And Jesse was the glue, you know, helped to build out the team, deeply empathetic, super smart human being. I want to say chief marketing because he's very, very creative. I don't, you know, think of him when I think of a typical COO, but he is also operational in his thinking and has a, you know, has an incredible understanding of, you know, supply chains. And so was thinking of ballots and election administration, you know, as, you know, the supply chain of all this and where is it kind of broken. But yeah, so that's where, and he, his background is in also in marketing, but he's, you know, that was a, even startup Priceline was what, in the 90s now? He then a bunch of time, as I said, sort of in climate change, has started this thing called ReFed, which is around food supply chains, right? And food waste. And he and Betsy, they do a lot of work with farmers and conservation. And they're just, you know, very awesome people. You know, they've done well and they do good.
I think we have a really big overlap in our interests in entrepreneurship and progressive politics and technology. And I've interviewed a lot of people who are running organizations that you've mentioned being affiliated with or being part of your portfolio. So, like, I would love to explore that more. If you can be specific about, here's national vote by mail, this is what we did, or this is what we're learning. One of the things I'm also interested in is, how do people running these find help? How do they find people who understand entrepreneurship, who understand scaling, who understand, you know, relationships, that all of these things that I'm, that I think you're part of bringing to them?
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, I think, and I want to be super clear for a lot of these folks. I mean, they were just super crazy generous with their time. And I think on the onset, like, I came into this project, you know, seeing a problem, right? But not necessarily understanding what the potential solutions are, or even fully the players. Like, in my work in politics, you know, I knew folks like, you know, the work you did within
NGP Van. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like the van, like we talked about the van.
The NGP side, to be honest.
There you go. Yes. There you go. Right. Yeah. So, like, it's like, you know, we talked about the van all the time. So I knew of folks who had done some stuff in that space, but certainly I didn't know the guts. I knew Rock the Vote. I knew the folks out there doing voter registration, you know, and this is, you know, back in the day. I certainly didn't know the vote by mail group, or even,
is that the Amber McReynolds?
Reynolds, yeah. Who's just a rock star, right? And she started, I mean,
she was on my show and talking about it. And, you know, she's, you know, everybody who's in that space knows her, but most of the world doesn't know of her at all, right? These are very fairly niche things, even though, yes, they're important.
Yeah. And what's interesting, depending on, it's a thoughtful and conservative small C group, right? Because at the end of the day, it's wanting to do right by election administration. So I don't even know how I got to Amber, but I did. And I don't know how I got to the folks at Center for Secure and Modern Elections. And I think they deliberately, you know, historically have kept a fairly low profile, in part because somehow elections end up being politicized, right? And I mean, that sounds almost naive, but the
administration does.
The administration, yeah, of the process of elections, right? And so one of the things that I went into this saying was, like, thinking, okay, we have secretaries of state and we have election officials. So I just called up a friend at Brennan, who is in this space, who used to be a Rock the Vote and has been an election official, and she schooled me on a whole bunch of stuff. So there was an education process, sort of, you know, going back to, if I'm building something, what's the stuff, right? Who are the players? What are everybody's perspective on it? And so folks like Amber and some other both consultants in this space, and as I said, I think they could keep a deliberately low, quiet profile because they work with secretaries of state who are not necessarily accustomed to being in the spotlight, except sometimes in a negative way. So they're just trying to move this thing forward, and it's not either a natural place and sometimes not a wanted space, right, to be in. But the reality is, like it or not, here we are. I sort of got a lot of information from them and also then made my way to other folks. And then, so I'm not,
I'm not working specifically with the Vote by Mail Institute, but I learned from them and then have taken what they are doing. And I know they're looking to raise money. And so, frankly, you know, have said to other folks that I know are working in that, you know, working in that space, here are some groups that are, and Jesse's doing the same. It's like, you know, here's some groups that are doing really great work, how to get dollars in. Not that they couldn't use more money, but, you know, they're, in terms of both providing good talent to them, there's been some opportunities afoot to do that, to whether to the secretaries of state or to the organizations themselves. There's been other work afoot through family offices, through philanthropic networks, to provide these groups with money and in-kind support. I think they may disagree with me, but I'm getting some sense that they're bursting at the seams, right? It's not unlike what happened with the ACLU a number of years ago when they were raising a bunch of money. There's a certain point, it's like, stop, enough, or what happened in Minnesota after George Floyd's death, like outpouring of support. And then there's a point that they just need to go forward and do some of their work. So I think what's been interesting for me, I frankly think Amber is, you know, a pretty creative thinker, and I haven't talked to her in a while, but I've talked to other folks about other things she's involved in, and I think she's got a level of expertise. And so I see other people in this entrepreneurial space trying to center her more because she is such a powerful voice. And some of the work that we're doing is looking to do the same. For example, Jenna Griswold in Colorado. Colorado has a history of vote by mail. You know, secretaries of state are often not the ones out there talking about it, not, you know, being the voice, the name, the advocate for that, because it just hasn't been the way to do it. So we're working with Jenna to combat disinformation, and it's just a merry band of revelers. We're a little bit of a, it's just a small team of people to tell that story around the safety and security and effectiveness of having a vote by mail system, for example. With the Center on Secure Modern Elections, they have something called Democracy is Good for Business, which is bringing in businesses to be not unlike Civic Alliance, but slightly different bands here. They work a lot with all those folks to bring more businesses and business leaders, those nonpartisan, cross-partisan voices, to be supportive. And they're super smart about that. And they've, you know, the team at the center and some of the works, the folks they work with, their consultants in that space, understand that world, and I think are agile enough that they need to be more entrepreneurial. They seem like the funding's there, right? So it's more about where are some of the connections, where are some of the assistance in bringing some business leaders to the table. And so that's where, at least, you know, so far I've come in with my own networks around, certainly at Startup America, some of the work I've done in New York City and elsewhere are bringing some other business voices to the table.
How would they, for example, see your role with them? Do they see you as an advisor? Are you on their board? What's the connection there?
Yeah, I don't know that it's so formal. I think that's in some ways, my challenge about how do I describe what I do. I'm not an advisor. We're collaborating. We're collaborators, right? I kind of brought an idea to them. I said, what do you think about this? Tell me if it sucks. Tell me what works, what doesn't work. Like, who would I work with to make this happen? Is it even a good idea to bring, you know, business people? Is it a good idea to, you know, and is it in your wheelhouse or somebody else's?
So that was your idea that you were mentioning there?
Again, they've already had, you know, for me, I said, what are businesses doing? How do we bring more businesses and business leaders to the table to support safe and secure elections? And my big thing was, you know, I think it's great when people stand up and say, this is important, right? We need to ensure the health and safety of our elections, and you shouldn't put your health at risk to be able to vote. And we have to have a plan, and we have to do it a couple different ways. And they said, absolutely, there's a couple things already, you know, in the works. I was like, well, how do we give it? Is there a way to give it more teeth? Is there a way to, you know, to promote more action, to have voices stand up? And not so much them, but some other, you know, I had a little bit of cold water thrown on me. I don't know if it was them so much, but within some of the business community that, you know, it's somebody running a business has about a million and one things on their plate, right? And there are certain organizations, you know, we could probably name the progressive type organizations, Patagonia, is the Ben and Jerry's of the world, and, you know, Reid Hoffman is viewed as a progressive, you know, person because of, you know, his support for Democrats. And so by extension, you know, any work he's involved in has that sheen to it. But that it's a reach for a lot of business leaders to come out, particularly in today's environment, which is so partisan and so charged. So in any event, it was just something I pushed and I drove a concept paper. They, you know, I have no part of authorship. They made it better. And so we're now, you know, how do we go out and pitch some folks? So we're in the process of just pitching some folks. And some people say, you know, no, you know, not my wheelhouse. And some folks are saying yes. And then related to that, I've been, you know, trying to find the right home for what I'm good at and like to do, which is that grassroots sort of ecosystem. Where are the businesses on, you know, on a local level? Where's the, you know, the coffee shop and the local marketing firm or whatever it is that has customers and has employees that they can reach to encourage to register to vote, become a poll worker, as appropriate, open up their place of business and support election. And so there's a number of organizations, you know, the national, I'm going to get it wrong. There's a program that's run through When We All Vote called Civic Cities. And I've been talking to those folks about what might be a set of pilots that we can do since they're working with mayors. So we connect business leaders to mayors within communities to bring together a coalition of the willing to support voter registration, vote early, and donate either in-kind goods and services or as appropriate money under election laws, because it's, you know, it's dependent state by state, locale by locale, to support elections. And you know, that was one of the things back to, you know, you can't do that, I was told, except you can. You know, private money can be used in certain instances to support elections. You know, financing technology, donating PPE, donating disinfectant wipes, donating space, you know, and certainly donating airtime, if you will, to reach employees and customers. So it's looking at what's kind of out there and saying, hey, I have this, you know, idea about how does this feel to you? Does this work? And if so, can we partner on it where I've got some folks who live in this camp who could be valuable to some of your efforts. And so a lot of the, you know, some of the work with these organizations is seeing some of the stuff that they've done and seeing if there's something else we can add on top of it or adjacent to it. And if not them, seeing if there's someone else that could be doing it. And so the poll worker thing, you know, it was something that I've been obsessing over. Reality was, Center for Secure and Modern Elections or a whole other coalition of people already working on it, you know, not a new idea and super smart people already doing it. So with that, I just said to them, I'm happy to help with my networks to, you know, to bring other partners to bear to be recruiting arms for, you know, for you. And part of it is a passion project for me, you know, where do I as a citizen do it? And part of it is, you know, with my work with Jesse, it's like, okay, where can I just bring my own connections and, you know, influence, if you will, to bear? I don't know if it's a partnership or collaboration or just like, I'm just trying to see what their efforts are and bring things to be helpful. And in certain instances, I, you know, the challenge around money, as I said, what I'm hearing in certain instances, in some places is, you know, we got this, we've got the money. In other instances, it's that they don't. And so there's, again, networks of donors that I have access to, Jesse has access to, that we're trying to bring those opportunities to those folks. And I just stumbled across another one that's not related, hasn't been related specifically to my group, that's called Big Tent. And it's a coalition of moderate women, Democrat, Republican, Independent, that is doing a whole bunch of activity, and a piece of which is also, you know, funding some, you know, the individuals within it, you know, are funding some of these efforts, these sort of unusual efforts. And I haven't done anything with the work I'm doing, but are looking at other, you know, projects like, let's just say, the Lincoln Project or other efforts out there. So I'm seeing pockets of dollars that are going to support these efforts in a way, I think that, I mean, I haven't seen before, but I'm hearing from folks who do this work that feels unprecedented.
A lot of people are seeing how critical this fall is going to be. Is there more orderliness than it sounds from your quick telling out there? It sounds a little bit like people dabbling, but maybe that's not what really is going on. Let me ask a question this way. Like, what advice would you give to people who, you know, have the kinds of assets that you have that are not yet as proficient in the kind of terminology and space, the progressive ecosystem, in how to become useful in helping people move things forward in the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, I could see why it feels like dabbling. That feels a little dismissive.
I'm all for all the help we can get.
What's the Margaret Mead quote that people get so overused? Something starts with, you know, whether it's one person or a collective people, about finding your people, finding your group who share passion or perspective
tribe.
On something.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't sure if that's the right word given the environment. Am I appropriating? But, you know, in any event, that's my, it's like find your passion and then find your family. Right. And listen, volunteer, lose the ego at the door, lose the sense that you have any of the answers, and, you know, volunteer, support, you know, do whatever it is that need be, bring whatever asset you might have, if it's money or connections or just, you know, willingness to, you know, make phone calls all day long or answer phones all day long. I don't know what it is. Try not to distract from the work, right? I mean, that's why the dabbling, I think,
doesn't feel right as a term. Yeah.
Well, because dabbling, look, I mean, as somebody who, look, I did fundraising for a period of time, and I worked for a congressman, and I worked with a lot of really well-meaning, super smart, crazy people. And I did it with Startup America too. Like, I worked with a lot of really smart within the Obama administration, beyond the Obama administration. I am guilty of the same. So there, I'm sure sometimes that, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, why is she here? Where we think we know what the answer is, right? But I go back to, that's why I think, you know, having an entrepreneurial mindset is really good. It's like, because people too often start with the solution. And as opposed to what is really the problem? Entrepreneurs do it too. It sounds like entrepreneurs are the only ones who do it. But I think, you know, I see that within funders, philanthropists, venture, whoever else, people at the top of things, business people, they think they know what the answer is, as opposed to being humble and curious about, let's really identify the problem and talk to and really try to understand what potential solutions could be and then test the heck out of them, right? There's an aspect, because it's exploratory. So could you look at it as dabbling? I look at it as like learning and understanding and doing some stuff and then seeing if it works or not. And then with like-minded people who are game to move forward on that same journey. But we all have different approaches. I mean, I work with some folks just as a thought partner, you know, who work with secretaries of state who are way more conservative, small C, you know, no, you can't do this. No, you can't do that. It's like, oh yeah, you know, but they're, you know, I'm helping them think about their work differently. I'm probably giving them a whole bunch of, you know, free guidance that they then go use in their, you know, in their work with the secretaries of state. This is not, I'm not talking about somebody like Amber, who's, I think, really smart, but some other folks in that space that I've been connected up with who are thinking about these things. I think for anybody who wants to get involved, it is really finding the tribe, the family, the group of people in the area that you want to, and what is the value that you're bringing to the table, and don't be a taker. You know, I hope I'm not being a taker. I hope I'm being a giver to some extent. And I think also some people are open and some people aren't, right? And I get it. I'm the same way. I mean, I've had plenty of people, well-meaning people, particularly when I was working in politics and public service, who, you know, who wanted to define the problem, wanted to define the answer, and it's just wrong. I mean, it's, you know, it just wasn't the right thing. So anyway.
Kathleen, can you tell the story of Startup America, like how you came to be right there at the beginning and what you built there and what you bring from that forward to the types of groups you're trying to help now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So Startup America was sort of the brainchild of a combination of the Office of Science and Technology Policy led by this guy, Tom Khalil, who is now at Schmidt Futures, actually. There was a governmental piece to it, but there was also Startup America Partnership, which came out of Steve Case, and then Gene Case, the Case Foundation, and the Kauffman Foundation, which is the foundation of entrepreneurship, to really activate corporate America and iconic entrepreneurs to support startups in America. I think it was Steve and Gene largely who tapped this guy, Scott Case, no relation. Scott was the chief technology officer at Priceline. You've probably seen the thread here now. And was at the time leading Network for Good and Malaria No More. They led him to be the CEO. And Scott is another dear old friend from Wilton, Connecticut. It was an idea that this was, you know, we were going to build a platform and, you know, companies would donate in-kind goods and services and money to support entrepreneurs. It was as simple as that, right? And we had about $500 million when they launched in in-kind goods and services promised. We got to about 1.2 or 1.5 billion. I was leaving the congressman's office and Scott said, how do you feel about creating jobs for America? I said, I'm all in. And we went for, you know, an hour and a half walk and talk and talked about everything. And he said, well, you know, I don't really know what this thing is yet. Do you want to come in? It wasn't even a thing. It was a name, right? It was Startup America Partnership. And we knew we had Steve Case. We knew the Kauffman Foundation. We had the public-private with the White House. But we were separate. And he's like, I don't really know what it is. He's like, but, you know, I see maybe it's going to be have some state stuff affiliated with it. But I don't know. So you come in now and help me build it. Or you can come in a little bit later when we have some, you know, some meat on the bones and maybe run some of the state stuff. And I just said, now, you know, how do I not do now, right? How do I not be part of building this thing, which again, kind of got some arrows around it. I think because we had, you know, the firepower of Steve and we had the Kauffman Foundation and Steve and Gene were just incredible. The Case Foundation, their team there, one of the people I worked very closely with, this guy, Michael Smith, who now leads My Brother's Keeper, was the lead contact there. And the Case Foundation really operated as part of the Startup America team until we hired out some communications. We were tiny. We had, I don't know, 4 or 5 people on staff and then a larger network of entrepreneurial leadership. And we sort of just devised, you know, we had all this in-kind goods and services, but as we got out into the world and we built out a platform working with the New York Stock Exchange, we had Microsoft, Dell, American Express, American Airlines, Intel, I think that's it, maybe a couple others, like large national sponsors. And back in 2011, entrepreneurial ecosystems outside of Silicon Valley, a little bit New York, certainly Boston, MedSpace, was just not really, you know, people didn't believe in it. I'm not sure they do today, but more so today. People weren't talking about going to work for a startup, you know, the way they do now. You know, we built up this thing, but when as we talked to leaders and, you know, and we just decided to launch Startup Regions. And we worked with the governor of Illinois. And so Startup Illinois was the first. I think Startup Tennessee was the second. We worked with a serial entrepreneur who had founded the National Entrepreneur Center. We worked with Dallas Entrepreneur Center. So Startup Texas, Startup Connecticut, Startup Iowa. And we just either found people or they found us who wanted to build up their community. And they said, this national network is really nice, but we have to work locally and here are the things that we need. And so we listened and we realized this regional, the network itself was way more important than this platform of, you know, stuff from Google or LinkedIn. I mean, that stuff was nice, but they really wanted a community of people to share playbooks, to work through challenges, to figure out where they fit, how their ecosystem fit, how they built their ecosystem. And so I don't remember if Dallas Entrepreneur Center actually started during the Startup America time, but I ended up being an advisor to one of the founders there and being on their board. I worked with this group that's now Tech Inclusion. One of my personal flags that I carried was inclusivity and diversity, which we always said, but You can't just build it and they will come. It doesn't work that way. You have to go out to communities. You have to understand what the needs are. They have to know about us. We have to know about them. So I built a coalition, Start for America Women. I did a similar thing with communities of color. And we very proudly, in terms of our, you know, we had Start of America member companies, if you will, from all over the country, you know, 50 states. There was, I don't remember how many, I want to say 60,000, 50-something startups with probably 100,000 founders, which were something like started in full or in part by women. 42%-ish were people of color. I don't remember the numbers about how many jobs were created and dollars raised and all that, but it was significant. We worked with large corporates. We worked with local corporates. We worked with, you know, universities. We just developed a whole playbook, hired a woman to run our regional work, who then went on to start 1776 down in D.C. And this was when, you know, we worked very closely with Techstars, when Techstars was like three affiliates or whatever, you know. Worked with Mass Challenge in Boston when they were a year in. So worked with a lot of these organizations to connect folks up with one another. And in some cases, help them. We said, we're giving you no money. We're not going to give you Steve Case or Obama. But, you know, we'll work side by side with you to make stuff happen. And that's what we did. And as I said, things came out of it. The National Entrepreneur Center was stronger because of it, and they rose to some prominence. Where the Michael Burcham, who was the founder there, himself a serial entrepreneur, ended up sitting on, you know, the Entrepreneurial Advisory Council for, I believe, Obama, and some folks on the first Trump one after Trump won in 2016. Start of America ran 2011 through 13. And we were never meant to be, we didn't want to build another Washington-based nonprofit to support entrepreneurship. We were there to seed some ideas, try some things, work with, you know, and then have whatever we helped to seed take hold and go. And so, like I said, Dallas Entrepreneur Center, 1776, came out of that with this woman, Donna Harris, and this guy, Evan Burfield. 1776 then merged with another entity out of Philadelphia, and there was a fund that was started, and this other platform, Current Union, came out of that. And then Steve's Startup America became Up Global. We partnered with the Startup Weekend folks. That ended up getting folded into Techstars. And so it's like the stuff that worked and had legs either grew or got folded into something else. Other things like the Startup Champions Network, which is, you know, a community-based entrepreneurial-led organization, is out there and working with I'm not as close to them. I haven't been close to them in a number of years, but that came out of it. Steve Case still does Rise the Rest and has started a number of pretty significant funds that he runs, you know, either within or adjacent to Revolution, with, you know, pretty iconic people putting in significant dollars to that to invest in startups across the country, you know, outside of Silicon Valley in New York, but in both in Heartland and elsewhere. It's not too much to say that we changed the national conversation and the where startups fit, because again, I do not remember before that time walking into any coffee shop or bar or restaurant or party and hearing people talking about the startup they were working at or starting or going to work at. And so there was both that culture shift. We helped to support, amplify, give testimony around Jobs Act. We started Startup Day on the Hill. We worked with South By to start a whole entrepreneurial track there. We worked with CES to do the same. You know, so there were a lot of things that came out of it with a tiny group of people, but with firepower behind us, names and support, like influence more than money. Although, you know, big props to folks like Microsoft and American Airlines and American Express who did put in some dollars along the way, but really people putting in time more than anything.
It's a very different angle on the entrepreneurial ecosystem to see it from kind of above, to see it as a system, to work on how to make that system better there at Startup America, at Techstars, I guess, for a while as an entrepreneur in residence, and the kind of the work you're doing now. It's very different than sort of building a company within the ecosystem. It's a different set of experiences, but some of the same learnings.
Yep.
Do you ever aspire to make your own firm or nonprofit beyond the setup that you've got for yourself right now?
I go back and forth on it. I think there was a time with Startup America that I thought, all right, you know, we said this isn't going to be a thing. Should it be a thing? You know, should it be a thing that lives on? I didn't do that. My most recent work at American Heart Association was leading emerging strategies and ventures, which was, you know, all around how do you reimagine and innovate and change nature of philanthropy and, frankly, science, accelerate research, you know, build new companies within a large scale philanthropy or adjacent to it. I don't know if that's really my strength. I never say never, right? Like, if 10 years ago you said, I'm not going to be, it made more sense when I said it in 2005. You know, 10 years ago, if you told me I wouldn't be a lawyer, that I would have done, you know, five jobs, because I thought I was going to be a lawyer and I'd do big impact and interesting creative work in different spaces and I'd volunteer my time and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I would have just like laughed in your face, like, right, I'm going to go work for a congressman and I'm going to build out a this and a that and whatever. I'm going to work in healthcare and I work for the American Heart. You know, I just would have, it wasn't possible, but I don't know. I mean, I'm both opportunistic and I frankly am on my own sort of my own life's journey about what I want to do. At times I think, is there something that I want to build that I think I'm uniquely skilled to build? I gravitate to collaboration and to smart folk.
Is what you're doing right now in the democracy space, is that the right thing for you? Is that fitting?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's totally your passion. Yeah.
That's totally my passion. I mean, look, I mean, even, you know, as a young lawyer, I did voting rights. I cared deeply about inequity. I was always acutely aware of, you know, I've always been a feminist. I wouldn't say I was an intersectional feminist. I don't think I had the wherewithal, but probably about 10 years ago, I started to better understand and recognize intersectionality. And so I've always cared about what voices aren't being heard, who's not at the table. I just always recognize that having a set of voices and lived experiences, whether in business, whether in community, doesn't matter. You know, my thing with Startup America, I'd go to these groups or rooms of, you know, middle-aged white guys and young white guys and aspiring white guys. And they're like, we know the community. We're totally fine. We represent the entire community. And I'm like, well, do you know what this is in this group? Do you know what this is going on? And they didn't. When I advise companies, I have my own little measure, which is you're selling X, Y, and Z. I'm like, do only young white guys buy X, Y, and Z? Some people don't take it well. I had an old white guy tell me I was triggering him when I asked the question about what he was doing, which I was like, really? If you can't be challenged by the team you're building and the audiences you're trying to reach, then I'm not sure you should be in this business. I went to law school to make a big difference, and somehow I found myself on Wall Street for a period of time, which is sort of hilarious. But when I went to Texas, I was like, you know, well, great, because my passion project will be voter protection here in Texas. I worked for, you know, within a campaign for a period of time, but more as a volunteer. I was pretty active in the Hillary campaign back in 2016, and again as a volunteer, and frankly thought, okay, I need to get back to East Coast. I need to get back to more entrepreneurial efforts. I need to figure out what I'm doing, you know, on the go forward. This, you know, a large scale philanthropy while doing good work is not the best space for me. You know, I need things that move in a much more agile and potentially messy fashion. And I thought I'd go do something around certainly voter protection. I didn't see myself necessarily working in the Biden campaign or on a campaign, but in that space, right? Frankly, to your earlier question, the light bulb went off with me a little bit. I thought there's something around a company or a nonprofit, and I think some folks are doing it now, about that community piece, like the engagement with our institutions or building new institutions about building back up communities. Because I think so much, and maybe I'm naive or just optimistic, that so many of our problems are because we don't really know one another, and we otherize one another because we don't know them. We don't spend time. We don't understand people's pain. We don't understand people's vulnerabilities and challenges. And so particularly for people who don't look like us. And again, I say that as a white woman who has a fairly diverse group of people and have actively sought out, you know, to be challenged and in my world. So I thought that that was going to be the work that I was going to be doing, to find those organizations that were doing really community building in the broadest sense of the word, you know, through the lens of democracy and policy. And so in some sense, I stumbled into this, but it, you know, I'm not a woo-woo person, but it's somehow the universe was, you know, kind of made that happen. I worry about post-election. I worry about the challenges, you know, the threats to suppress the vote by the threat of threats. I worry about what's going to happen on election day. And I think there's still a lot of things that are broken. I tend to do best in those spaces, the, you know, the 1 to 3 year horizon on things. I don't want to say I get bored, but it's part of the reason why I left being a lawyer. I don't like to be the expert in the room. I really don't. And then carry something on long term. You know, the management of the thing is of less interest. I can do it. I'm, you know, can be neurotic about my own spreadsheets and timelines and all that kind of stuff. But I like to build. So I don't know if that answers your question.
But. I think it's your answer to the question. My question is what did the campaign and election and governance of Trump mean to you?
As a woman of a certain age, I want a woman as president. I want our leadership to reflect on every level, you know, the richness of our world. And it just doesn't, and it hasn't. And to me, when Trump was elected on so many different levels, you know, the surface levels and then deep down, it dashed, like, I don't know if I, in my lifetime, I'll see a woman. I hope still, but that was, you know, it was just devastating, frankly. I don't think I fully appreciated the agenda, whether it's of Trump himself or the forces and people around him to really, what I think is not to dismantle our democracy. I've always been worried about the courts. I think my first instinct afterwards, which I quickly came to my senses, was to go back and like go work for the ACLU, you know, go work for a legal organization. I'm like, dust off that law degree and go do stuff. And then I thought, they don't want me. I haven't practiced law in 10 years. You know, I haven't done civil rights law. There's way smarter people doing that. But I worry about that. And I think I think I was right. And it's the watching the packing of the courts, watching what's happened with the Supreme Court has been utterly devastating. And then some of the decisions that have come out of that, what's happening with the U.S. attorney's offices, that, you know, just picking apart and taking apart the safeguards and the things that are in our, you know, the separation of powers, the constitutional protections against despots and kleptocrats. And he has done way worse than I think I could have imagined, except for, as I said, I saw in my mind that path around the courts. I certainly worry about women's rights and civil rights and immigration. But I don't think in my wildest nightmares I could have imagined where we are, which is you have someone who has no respect for our democracy, no respect for any of the institutions or for ideals. A person and a family who is just in it for themselves. You know, as I heard on the call yesterday, I just got to wonder the amount of money the Trump campaign has spent, what has gone into the pockets of family members and cronies. But frankly, you know, I have spent a lot of time, active time, not trying not to think about Trump because he's a symptom, I think, rather than a root cause. And there's something that's deeply wrong in our country that put that person into power that existed before him. You know, he's not omnipotent, but there are forces at play here. And that's enraging, but more than enraging is really, really sad to me. At the first, you know, I was obsessively reading stuff and what can I do and all that, but it's like, I just got to focus on what I got to focus on because there's a new atrocity every single day. So I just have to think about where can I potentially put my own efforts and work on what I need to work on. We've seen an assault. We've seen an absolute assault on our Constitution and our democracy over time. I have friends who are Trump voters, largely people I've known for a long period of time that are kind of, as I say, grandfathered into my friend group. And some of them were no longer friends, you know, because I can't, especially people who have a lot of money and a lot of education, and I think should know better. You know, and I've got some friends who come from different parts of the world and who were deeply afraid of you know, their families. And so I think it's there's a misguidedness there. I think there's certainly some, you know, institutionalized racism going on, you know, but we're just a deeply divided country and that has to change. And I really want to be, part of that change. And these are really hard times. And his response to the administration's response and too many people's response to COVID, it's like, I would have, you know, I don't want to give Trump credit for anything, but if that administration had actually taken a leadership role in addressing this threat to the American people, I would have been ecstatic. I have, you know, friends who are sick, friends who are dying. And then
he missed his opportunity.
Oh my God. He absolutely did.
He could have cinched reelection by doing a responsible job.
Absolutely.
Just like every governor got popular who did a good job. It was a terrible thing. It's still a terrible thing, but it was a gimme to get it right, to pay attention to the people who know things. And instead he's just botched it so badly for so many people.
There was a call with, I don't know if it was the Lincoln Project or another sort of, you know, Never Trump group. It was exactly that. It's like, from a political perspective, leaving aside, you know, a scientific perspective, a humanitarian perspective.
Should be able to count who guy who wants reelection to, you know, even as much as he's obsessed with doing well and his ratings, he doesn't have the capacity to do the right thing that might even serve him. He just has too many flaws.
Right. And I, you know, whether, I mean, I don't go down the path. Is he mentally ill?
He is some kind of mentally ill, whether it's, you know, he just is.
Those are things that, you know, sometimes in my close circles and, you know, when I, you know, you have a glass of wine and you want to rail about something because it's like, how can you not? It's the train wreck. You can't look away except, you know, you're on the tracks. We're all tied down to the tracks to some extent. But I have to think about, because I care deeply. I mean, I do. I care deeply about my country. I care deeply about, I know my friends who are in pain, you know, my African-American friends who after the election, frankly, you know, looked at me and said, welcome to my life in America. This notion of, you know, yeah, I had
I've
a lot
heard,
of people say,
too.
You know, I mean, it's really nice that all you, and not in a bad way, you know, I mean,
oh, now you're politicized. I've had to be politicized for my whole family has had to be for generations.
When there was something, you know, these hideous shootings, my sister's in Minneapolis, she's a therapist there. She's deep in the ground working with community groups and, you know, friends here and, you know, longtime friends who either because they didn't think I'd understand or didn't for whatever reason, you know, I am hearing stories of their lives now and their experiences that I just haven't heard before. And I am understanding better and it is not on them to teach me, but it is also something, you know, I am always been committed to a more equitable America. I understand what that means more now. So I don't know where that's going to take me, frankly. You know, I have a 31-year-old and a 23-year-old, which is also unbelievable to me. And the 23-year-old in particular is like, Democrats, Republicans are all the same, you know, and he.
Not true.
And exactly.
Particularly right now. Yeah, I know.
I get it. But I also get, and he has voted in every single election. Like, that's the other thing. I mean, he had that both instilled in him, but he embraced it. And so he's like, Mom, you know, I voted and he voted for Hillary and, you know, and he's going to do what he's going to do. But he's like, you know, in some ways it's like, same day different. And he's not, you know, some call with Obama and Obama was saying he's seeing a lot with a lot of young people who don't feel like their voice matters. And so that is of concern. And so that is also like, I'm not the messenger there, but I've been talking to my son and he's just like, yes, I know all my friends are voting. And I'm like, what matters to you? But I do see this, you know, this organizing both around voting, but also around social change in so many different ways. And so I don't have all the answers, you know, it's both and, right? I certainly believe who leads matters, laws matter, restrictions matter, governments matter. I believe that, you know, and so whether it's changing from within, blowing up a system, developing other ones, you know, it's yes, right? The answer is yes. Young people, you know, I think have to vote. I mean, whether they will or not, a lot of people are working on it and a lot of people are doing it. There's going to be new ways of thinking. Right. And so for me, it's like, how do I help in that regard? Right. How do I help some of to your point about the dabbling, right. And getting involved. I think, unfortunately, you know, if you don't have money or connections, it's really freaking hard. And that's just not right. That's just not right. You know, it's just not right. I don't know the answer to it, but that's,
I've spent a lot of time over my career, but even the last month, like making stronger connections, like hire this person. Like, I know they have no track record in your book, but they're super smart and they've done this. Take a freaking risk. That's been almost exclusively with Black people and predominantly with Black women. And I'm being a little bit more aggressive about those kinds of things. And it's small, but it's also big, right? Yeah, but you got me thinking, now I got to be neurotic about what I'm doing next, because I do have to figure out some sort of, you know, life's work. But my life's work often finds me. So there's that.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about it.
Maybe what's my biggest fear, but my biggest hope, you know, with the upcoming election, you know, and my biggest fear is that Trump gets elected, right? And I don't think that's going to happen.
It's certainly possible. It's not over.
It's certainly possible. And, you know, I had this, it was this, you know, this Hobson's choice. Would you take eradicating coronavirus today if you got Trump? And I'm like, I'm not even going to answer that. But and my biggest hope is that despite all the messiness, despite all the challenges, that really this is an opportunity that America comes together. That people who think it's not their problem, it's not their issue, it's not their voice, or they don't have a say, recognize that it is, you know, that it's businesses and veterans and students and, you know, and that people choose hope, you know, people choose hope, and people not only hope, but they choose future, you know, that they believe in our country and in one another, and that it's the start of something, not the end. The election's just a point in time, right? But that we really start to rebuild what's been torn apart.
If we're kind of coming apart now, it would be nice to at least be on the path to coming together. Kathleen, really an honor to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
Not at all. Thank you. Except thank you. Thank you for the time and the platform, and thank you for indulging me and talking about this stuff. I really appreciate it.
That was Kathleen Warner with Inspire Ventures. She's at Kathleen D. Warner on Twitter. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.